Hey, it's Adam Peacock. Now, a couple of weeks removed, but wishing the A-League was still going. However, so thankful we got through it. It's been said a bit, but again, thanks to the players, staff of the clubs, people who helped organise the relaunch, it's actually the first Australian comp in any sport to get done in the midst of a trying situation for absolutely everyone. So it was a fair effort. Not just a fair effort, it was a huge effort. But time being a continual continuation, now what? What's next? My guest is the CEO of the FFA, James Johnson, and as usual, there's a bit to ask the person running football in Australia. Now, the temptation is to go short term. For instance, as I speak, the players and the clubs are trying to work out a new pay deal, a new CBA. Now, I will ask James about it and a few other newsy items, but the majority of this podcast will be the bigger picture stuff and the stuff I don't quite understand, which, being truthful, is quite a bit in life in general. But anyway, about this podcast, the basis will be the FFA's 11 principles. It's what the organisation is using to underpin the progress of the sport for the next 10 to 15 years at least, and how it will actually go from a neat-looking document and be put to real use in the football community. Welcome to the Fox Football Podcast. Yes, and James Johnson, the CEO of the FFA, is the guest. And James, thanks for your time. I mentioned at the top there about the 11 principles, which cover identity, narrative, the football economy, professional leagues, coach and player development, the female side of the game, national teams. Now, all of it put together is theory right now. How and when does it get put to effective use?
So I think, the first point is, Adam, we've issued a living document. And what we meant by living was that it's a document that we put on the table to discuss and to debate with key stakeholders in the game and also participants as well. So it's broader than just stakeholders. And we've gone through that process already. We've had many, many meetings, more than 20 meetings with stakeholders that have all lasted 90 minutes plus in some cases, where we've really got into a lot of the weeds around the 11 principles. We've gone public with surveys where participants and fans can contribute, and we've had thousands of responses. So what that's done is it's given us a really deep understanding on what's important to our stakeholders, what's important to the broader football community, where the priorities are, where things are less of a priority. And right now we're at a stage where we're bringing together that information, that understanding, where we would reissue the 11 principles. It would be a second and final edition. And that would include, obviously, the vision, the 15-year vision that we set, that would be nuanced based on the feedback we've got. And it would also start providing more practical measures around what it is we're going to implement and when. So that document is weeks away. We're working on it at the moment. We're hoping to have it out by the end of the month. And then it's actually about bringing the 11 principles to life. And I think we're already starting to get into this space where we're talking about new faces at FFA. We've got, obviously, Peter Philopoulos, who's come in. We haven't had a head of PR and communications for many, many years. But if we're talking about changing narrative, this point is correct. We're talking about bringing football into the centre of the organisation. And you're seeing a TD in Trevor Morgan being appointed, supported by Ron Smith, who is very well regarded in all football circles. We're talking about bringing players closer to the organisation again, and you're seeing bodies like the starting 11 pop up and having a meaningful role in football discussions. And you're going to see more and more of the practical implementation and the bringing to life of the principles in the coming weeks.
Such a fascinating time for the sport, because some people say that this pandemic that we're living through, it can really curtail what the sport's trying to do. Others see it as an opportunity. I dare saying that you being the optimist, you're going to see it as the latter. But one big pillar of it is obviously the professional game. And that is the part of the game that gets a lot of the headlines. We will delve into community issues, because that's equally as important given how many people play the sport. But at the moment, A-League, W-League independence, it seems to have been lasting for a very long time. Where are we exactly at with that? Because it is a part of the principle with you guys, the FFA, helping deliver a football product by through week-to-week football with the A-League and the W-League, but in a different way to what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the unbundling has taken a lot of time. That's a fact. When I came in January, it was a priority. Our priorities changed in March when the tsunami of COVID hit us, and our priority changed to, well, first of all, stopping the league in March. Then it was a case of renegotiating a new broadcast deal with Fox, a new CBA with the players at that point, and then bringing the clubs, the players, and the broadcaster together to restart the competition. And then the focus was on running the competition during COVID, where we're faced, or where the game, where sports is faced with different issues. Playing in bubbles, you would have been in one, Adam, so you would have seen firsthand what that was like, and it was very unusual. So the league only finished a couple of weeks ago now, so we're straight into negotiations with the clubs so we can finalise this once and for all. What we've done already in the past couple of weeks has been we've taken some practical steps. We've given the responsibility of league sponsorship sales to the clubs. So the clubs are now running this part of the business. They're also now accountable and responsible for the commercial sales for the league. And also with negotiating the CBA with the players, this is the first time that the clubs have directly dealt with the PFA in the negotiation of a new CBA. So there are practical steps that are being taken. As for the actual legal exchange, we're into the weeds with the clubs at the moment, and I'm hoping in the next weeks and months we can actually make that happen. But it is a priority for us. You know, there's discussions about second-tier competitions and other professional game issues, but our number one priority is the implementation of the unbundling.
With that unbundle, I likened it a little bit to a mature young adult deciding that they want to move out of home, and then the parents happily let them go, and then the mature young adult have to work out life in the big bad world by itself. When does the adult have to come in and help out from time to time, i.e. a CBA with the players or something like that, a current topic, for instance? I mean, how much of a relationship will there be, and how close will it be as time moves on?
So if we talk about the models, there are many models that exist in football, because many football associations have been through unbundling, and usually it's a result of the maturing of a professional market. So we have a lot of examples that we can look at, a lot of models that we can learn from. I personally am not a fan of copying and pasting the Premier League model. I know that many people are, because it's the big league of the world and the most visible league around the world. But we do need to remember that the Premier League model has really been developed over a 140-year period. So in 1880-ish, you had the Football League that split from the Football Association. And then it wasn't until 1990-ish that the Premier League split from the Football League. So this model has developed over 140 years. And I personally think that jumping to a Premier League model overnight is a little bit too far, or going too far too soon. But there are other league models and other leagues that exist around the world, like the J-League and the JFA relationship, like the Bundesliga and the DFB relationship, or like the Chinese FA and the Chinese Super League relationship, where unbundling has happened in a staged approach. And what happens in these models, and these are models where the league has unbundled in recent times, is there's a stronger connection between the rest of the game, in particular the governing body, and the league. And in my view, these are the types of models that we need to be looking at and learning from and replicating aspects of if we're going to be successful in this unbundling process.
I mean, how do you maintain that bond, though, without you stepping in their territory and them stepping in your territory, for instance, over young players who might be needed to go to Olympics, but they want to keep them here for the leagues, and there's not that residual kind of resentment going forward that this is our turf, stop stepping on it?
Yeah, well, I think, look, what is the core responsibility of a league? And for me, there's a number of them. One is actually operating the competition itself, so administering the competition. I think in any model, this has to be done by the clubs when you have a league. Otherwise, you don't have a league, right? And so this is something that the league needs to do. Representing itself in employer-employee relationship negotiations, such as the CBA negotiations, this is a key part of a league. Being able to sell your own properties for the league, this is another key responsibility. But there's also a lot of other areas which typically sit with a federation, particularly in models like Japan, like China, which I mentioned before, such as when the competition is played, the national football calendar, when the league fits into the overall national football calendar. This is something that I think certainly the clubs understand that we need to play and continue to play an important role in. When it comes to roster squads and transfer systems and rules around your rosters and the registration of players, this is something that is often done by the federations in conjunction with the league. So the point I'm trying to get at, I think we've got to go back to what are the real core responsibilities for our league. And for me, they're administering the competition. They're working directly with their employees, that is the players and the PFA in our case, in CBA negotiations, and also being able to exploit the commercial properties of the league. And I think these are really the core aspects of a league and what we should really be focused on ensuring the clubs can do as we unbundle.
This chat's more about the bigger picture rather than getting into the nitty-gritty of the news of the day. But one thing on that, congrats on the PFA and the FFA, Socceroos Matildas, for instance, CBA, and the continuation of something that's world-leading in terms of equality with payments to both men and women. But the other half of that, of course, is the clubs. Are you confident that they'll sort it out? You won't have to stick your head in and help out?
Look, there's a lot of competence in club land and also in PFA land. And I think you've got a very complex negotiation. This is a reality. There's less money in the market in our Australian football economy, which is quite normal if you look at other industries within Australia, but also other football industries around the world. So it's not something that's specific to Australia, and I think that's an important point. It is complex, and it's hard. These are sensitive negotiations. I think that we need to give the parties time to try to find solutions that or find areas that both the PFA and the clubs can land on. These negotiations have not been going on for too long. They've been going on since the day after the league finished. So I think we've got to give them time, and we've got to give them the autonomy that they need to try to figure out what works for them both. But ultimately, if it escalates, if it becomes more sensitive, if it looks like the current impasse is going to continue and there is not going to be a resolution, then certainly we're going to have to enter these discussions and try to help the parties reach an agreement
and get football back out there. week in, week out, the A-League and the W-League as well, which will be good to see. You mentioned there the football economy. So back to the big picture stuff, a pillar of the principles is the football economy and how we grow it and how we develop it in Australia, because basically we're not involved in the international transfer market in any way, shape or form, or in a meaningful way, put it that way, given how much is out there waiting to be, like, the pie's big and we get none of it, basically. That's what I'm trying to say. So how does Australia get inside its football ecosystem, from professional clubs to NPL clubs, even down to grassroots clubs? How do we develop that aspect of our game, and how indeed crucial is it that we do?
Well, I think it's extremely crucial. I think if we look at the typical business model of football and sports of the past 20 years, there's really been three main revenue streams. There's been broadcast, there's been sponsorship, and there's been match day revenue. Now, in our case, there's less broadcast monies. Sponsorship is also, there's less of it around at the moment. And of course, we can't have, or we're very limited in our spectators and our fans being able to watch football matches in stadiums, which means there's less match day revenue as well. So I do think we need to be looking at different ways in which we can bring revenues into the sports. There's two alternative ways which I think require a lot of thought around. One is capital investment, and the other is a transfer system. And a transfer system is a system that we've never really got the benefit of. We've seen recently that Kasace went to Belgium for 2.1 million New Zealand dollars. That was what was reported. And this amount of money is more than the aggregate amount of transfer fees per year that we've ever got. So there's money there. It's a $10 billion industry, the transfer system, and $10 billion is combining the aggregate amount of international transfers around the world with the aggregate amounts of domestic transfer fees in the big five leagues. It's $10 billion. And we typically get between $1 and $2 million of that $10 billion. And that's actually not good enough, because if you look at countries like Scotland or Japan or Korea, countries that we are certainly able to benchmark ourselves against, they are generally generating between $30 and $50 million per year. That's the amount of transfer revenue coming into the economy. And that's certainly not where we are at the moment.
No. But it's one thing to say that, yeah, we want a football economy and be really bullish about it, but to be involved in any kind of economy, you've got to have a decent product to put yourself into the marketplace with. So is the most central part of developing a football economy making sure that the production line and the football calendar and all of those things and clubs and FFA are all aligned with the thought of, we're all in this together, we have to develop players in the best way together? Or is it too fractured in Australia the way it's set up, with member federations and professional clubs and NPL clubs all wanting their little piece of how they do things?
So I think there's two components. If we want to take advantage of the international transfer market, I think there's two components. The first, as you said correctly, Adam, is the production line, and that means that we need to produce, of course, not only better players, but we need to create more opportunities for young Australian players. If we can have more young Australian players playing more match minutes in the A-League, for instance, their value on the international transfer market will increase. So if you've got a 21, 22, 23-year-old that is playing regularly in a league like the A-League, the value of that player, the transfer value, will be higher than if that player is not playing. I mean, this is a reality, and this is how clubs, particularly in Europe, who are the big players in the transfer market, it's how they value players. They look at how old the player is, how often they're playing at the domestic level, and also their national team performances as well. And they value the player usually based on those metrics. So anyway, production line is absolutely key. The second point is the system, and ensuring that our contracting system, our transfer system, our player status, so to speak, system is able to be hardwired into the international system. And things like the length of contract, that's important, because if you have players that are on contracts for only 1 or 2 years, it means that they're going to be free agents sooner than if they had contracts for 3 to 5 years, for example. And what a club will do, particularly a club in Europe, is they'll look at the length of contract, the length that the player has before the contract expires. And if the player's only got 6 to 12 months left, and often the club will wait for the player's contract to expire, which means there's no transfer fee, which means there's no revenue going back to the club of origin. The other point with the system is the alignment of calendar. So if, for instance, the European transfer window opens in the European summer, as we know it does, and our contracting year finishes 31 May, which is what it does, and we also know that in any given year, one third of our players come off contract, then that means that every year, one third of our players are coming off contract at a time when the European window opens up. So these are the kind of system changes that we need to look at, and some of the changes we're going to need to make in order to hardwire ourselves into the international transfer market.
What about the internal transfer market between NPL clubs and also A-League clubs? I'm getting into the realm of like 13, 14, 15-year-olds as well, getting identified at an NPL club and going to an A-League academy, which seems to be the thing at the moment. Adelaide do it a bit different. They let them develop through the centre of excellence down there in Adelaide and then pluck the best 16, 17-year-olds to, as we see with what happened after COVID, is develop them into straight into the A-League team if they're good enough. But how do we ensure that the NPL lifeblood clubs, I call them, around the country are getting duly compensated for players that have been in their system and then going up to the A-League system?
It's crucial, and it's a great question. So this is where we start talking about a domestic transfer system. Adam, we just talked about the international system and how our system needs to link in to the international system. But yes, I do believe we need to create a domestic transfer system. And what we mean by that is we need to create a system where clubs all over the country are incentivized to develop players. And of course, there's economical benefits with a domestic transfer system, but there are also sporting benefits. And the benefit is if you can change the mentality of clubs all around the country to one of, if I develop a player and I lose that player, I'm going to be compensated for it, then this is a good thing. This is a good thing because the clubs will naturally then want to invest in youth development. And the more they invest in youth development, the more or the better the production line is, and ultimately the more revenues that come back into the sport. So this is what a domestic transfer system would do. What it would concretely look like is you would see potential transfer fees payable while players are under contract, and the transfer fee is a payment, for lack of a better word, for breaching the employment contract and the transfer of the registration. You would see also a training compensation system, which is a payment for players who are no longer contracted, but would go to clubs that have contributed to training that player over a certain period of time.
It's a difficult system because we're talking about young players as well. So we're talking about people who aren't even old enough to register for a tax file number and things like that, the transfer. And there is a bit of a sentiment out there, I've noticed, that it's just, that the A-League clubs will pluck the kid, and it's good for the kid. They get to go to a better environment and training with better players around them, and it's good for the A-League club. They get their good player. But the NPL club are left with, oh, cool. Well, all we can say is he was here or she was here, and that's it, pretty much.
Yeah, I think that's right. And look, the first point to that is, it's a whole system. It's not a transfer system. Isn't just going to benefit the top tier league. It really does benefit all parts of the system, all the way down to your grassroots clubs, who can benefit from it. And I think you're right. I mean, once the transfer system is up and running, what you'll see is that players will go up the line. They will go up. They'll go from a local club to an NPL club, or an NPL club to an A-League club. And that's good, but then there'll be a distribution that goes down. And you can look at that in two ways. One is it'll become more expensive for clubs, It will, but the benefit is we will develop better players, and ultimately there'll be more money available in a transfer market because our production line is higher. So it's a good system. It's one that works in many parts of the world, and it's proven.
When are we going to see it here, do you reckon?
Plans are in motion. We talked before about bringing the 11 principles to life. You'll see very soon a circular that goes out to the football community. It will be twofold. One will be about the international system, and we'll have an educational workshop where we can start educating all our 2,500 clubs across the country around the benefits of the international transfer system, what training compensation really means, what to do in a practical sense if a player moves abroad. If you can't get the training compensation, should clubs negotiate a sell-on clause, for example? So it'll be a very practical and educational program, if you like, which will educate all our clubs. On the other hand, we'll be starting a discussion with the football community around what a domestic transfer system would look like. So what are the rules around loaning players? What are the rules around transfer fees? What are the calculations when it comes to training compensation? How do the transfer windows relate to the transfer system? What are the rules around competition administrators when it comes to homegrown players? This is all part of a domestic transfer system. And like the 11 principles, where we went out and we consulted the football community, we'll do the same thing with the domestic transfer system.
Now, if I don't ask this question, I get torched on Twitter. So it's the obligatory second division question. James, where are we at with it? I noticed this week that the Association of Clubs have come out and said, yeah, 30 of them around the country are ready to go. Whatever it's looking like, it's going to be called the Championship, we understand. So all of those things are in place. What's crucial for you as we sit here? Because the way I look at the top division in Australia still needs a bit of work. So where do we sit with the second division and making that a meaningful, existent, giving it a meaningful existence in Australian football from the start and making sure it's sustainable?
So our priority right now is on the unbundling of the A-League, and we need to unbundle, and we need to ensure that the A-League is able to navigate its way with the support of FFA out of this difficult period. This is, of course, our priority. A second-tier competition, look, it's a great thing. I don't think at a conceptual level anyone should disagree with that. I certainly don't. It's a great thing. It means more football being played at a national level. It means more match minutes for young Australian players. It means more opportunities for coaches, for referees, and for administrators. It's a good thing, a second tier competition. I think we need to move away from the conceptual debate. I don't think there is a debate anymore. It is a good thing. But we really need to get into the practical discussions around how we would finance a certain amount of clubs that could compete at that level, and also how we finance the competition administration side as well. And we need to have that practical discussion. And from our side, if there is a practical solution to having a second tier, this is fantastic. And if it helps us achieve our strategic objectives, which are included in the 11 principles, more match minutes for players, more opportunities for coaches, more football being played at a national level every weekend, then this is a good thing.
We'll wait and see. We'll wait and see with it. As I said, I had to ask the question. I mean, is there a model around the world that might suit, or are we getting ahead of ourselves here? Like, what might suit Australian football with its geographical challenges as well? Have you got a preferred?
I personally think that the sequence is you have to agree on the concept first. I think this is there. This is, for me anyway, an old discussion. Then you need to discuss why you want a competition. And for me, that's the strategic discussion. More minutes for more players, more opportunities for coaches. This is the second part of the discussion. Then there's a discussion that is practical, and that's finances. Can we do it financially? And only then do you go into a discussion on what the model could look like, the competition model, that is. There are numerous competition models around the world. We know in England, for example, you have three different entities. You have the FA, you have the Football League that runs the second tier competitions, and you have the Premier League. We know if you look at Mexico, for instance, they have two competitions every one calendar year. If we look at Brazil, they have a relationship in their national competitions between state level competitions and national competitions. So there are lots of models. There's the US model, which is a conference model. I think we need to put the horse before the cart, and I think the model is the last discussion. It's not the first discussion.
And then there's the wonderful notion of promotion relegation, which personally I can't quite see legally happening. And I know everyone would love it. I'd love it. I'd love last day of the league to mean so much. But the clubs, haven't they not signed deals until 2034 to be part of an A-League? How do you relegate someone out of that?
Yeah, so the discussion on promotion relegation is an interesting one. I mean, as a football fan, I love it. It's exciting. It's great, but it doesn't apply in every market, and that's not to say it shouldn't. It just doesn't. That's the reality. I think we need to talk about promotion relegation in a broader sense, in an access sense. And if you look at the access to competitions all around the world in different leagues, people have different views on what promotion relegation actually means. I like to use the example of Mexico and Japan. In Mexico, the way that they've introduced sporting merit concept into their access at domestic level is that the team that does the poorest over 3 years, which means six seasons, because they have two competitions every 1 year, the team that on aggregate over 3 years does the poorest is relegated. And that's how they implement promotion relegation. In Japan, for example, they have a very high level club licensing system, and although some clubs in the amateur game can be promoted to the professional game, because the standards are so high, it often is a theoretical discussion. We see a point calculation when it comes to clubs in Europe when they access the UEFA Champions League. So it's a much broader discussion than just the typical three up, three down English style, and I think it's one that we can have, and we can look at many different models in doing so.
One of my favourite little clubs in Australia could be a part of that, the Mexican model, the Los Marinos, so to speak. But I'll leave that one out there. Hey, a couple of quick ones before I let you go, because I know you're super busy. It's plenty on your plate at the moment. Government support. So I don't know where government support comes in the future. Does it come around helping with national teams and especially youth national teams, or is it infrastructure around the country? I know you're building those connections, which is great to see, and especially those down in Victoria, they've done a really good job about building connections with state government around infrastructure. But how does it build? How does it develop? Because it's a big part of what's going to happen going forward.
So I think our role in government relations in the past has not been as strong as other sports. I think this is a fact, and it's an area that we've really got to improve and get stronger in. I mean, that's the reality for our organisation. That's FFA, by the way. Government relations are done both at federal level and state level, and we do have, with some of our member federations, many great examples, like Victoria, where we recently got major funding for a home of the Matildas. Our big opportunity, though, as a sport, is the 23 Women's World Cup, and I'm very confident that we're going to get a very nice legacy program together, which will come with a lot of government support. And currently, we're working with our member federations, our A-League clubs, in putting together what we see as government support through legacy. And some of these we've been public about. We've talked about a home of football. We've talked about more facilities for the ever-increasing number of grassroots participants. So I'm quite confident with the Women's World Cup ahead of us that our support from government through legacy is going to increase.
Yeah, just on the Women's World Cup, I don't want to be flippant about it, but 20 years ago, pretty much to the day, we were putting on the greatest Olympic Games that's ever been. We know how to put on big events in Australia. The Asian Cup was superb. as well. You got Jane Fernandez there running it. She ran the bid, and now she's in control of putting the whole thing together. I'm pretty certain, I'm not being flippant, it's going to go off and it's going to be fantastic. But is the key to the Women's World Cup, without skipping over the detail of putting it on, what we have left out of it and something to really look back on in 40 years and go, wow, that changed things in a really great way?
Yeah, look, it's exciting, right? And it is a, you know, we are going to have a challenging period for the next 12 months as a sport. All sports are, mind you, in Australia. All football associations around the world are. But I think this is our big opportunity. We're in a very fortunate position because of the Women's World Cup. A lot of our strategy and our vision is going to be around that tournament. I think if we look 20, 30, 40 years down the track, what is our legacy? We're going to see on the participant side more girls, more women playing sports. At the moment, we have this huge participation base, but less than 25% are women's and girls. So this is our big opportunity for growth in terms of participation. So I'm hoping that this will be a big legacy where we can get to the same number of girls and boys playing football, which lifts our total number of participants. We're going to have a place we can call home, a home of football where the football community can come to. We have high performance facilities within the home of football. Perhaps we have a museum where we can recognize the historical achievements of the sport. This is really important for us. And also facilities around the country. I mean, one thing that I didn't understand so well before coming into this role is the lack of facilities. And some of our competition administrators around the country are having to turn away participants simply because we don't have enough football facilities. So this is another area. So there's a lot to come out of this Women's World Cup, and they're just some of the things I'd like to see be legacy pieces.
Last one, Matilda's coaching job. It's still vacant. How long is it going to be vacant for?
Not for too long, Adam. Look, it's been a great process. We've had a lot of football acumen around the table with Remo Nogarotto and Amy Duggan, Mark Bresciano, Sarah Walsh, Trevor Morgan, myself. We're debating. We've gone out on a serious scouting mission. We're really wanting to get someone that can come in and doesn't need training wheels, someone that understands the women's game. That's important to us. We want someone that can lift and optimize the performance of this team, and it's strategic. The strategic reason is it's a four-year cycle. We have the Olympics in Tokyo, then we have the Asian Cup in India in 22, World Cup in 23 on home soil, and then the Olympics again in Paris in 24. And we have this great core group of players who are going to be peaking during this period. So we need to bring a coach in that can really help them optimize their performance during that period. So we hopefully can win something in those 4 years.
That'd be nice to put smiles on everyone's faces in Australian football. Doesn't happen that often, but it'd be good for it to happen. James, thanks so much for your time on the Fox Football Podcast. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Adam. Great to chat.